Welcome to Strong Tower Radio Today. The views and opinions expressed on this show do not necessarily reflect the views of Strong Tower Radio, West Central Michigan Media Ministries, or its employees.
Hello, folks. Welcome to Strong Tower Radio Today, and I'm your host, Tom Majeure, and I have my co-host, Sue Majeure.
Good morning. It's good to be here.
You may recognize that there are similarities in the last name. This happens to be my baby sister, and she likes the name baby sister, so... Well, she's shaking her head no. Anyway, I just want to thank you for all that. My sister, our program today is the gardening program. And we do this once a month with Gary Heilig. Welcome, Gary.
Happy to be here.
Gary, we affectionately call him the garden guy. And he's a retired agent from the Michigan State Extension Service. And just a blessing. We look forward to this every month. Well, before we get started, let's have a word of prayer. Our great Heavenly Father, we just want to thank you for your creation. You have provided us a way for gardens, for both enjoyment and also sustenance. And Lord, not only do we get a blessing from viewing and consuming, but we also get a blessing in the work. And so, Lord, I just ask for a blessing on our speech today, that our listeners will find some gem to take to their garden and enjoy. In Jesus' name, amen.
Amen.
Well, Sue, why don't you start it off with the very first question for this week's Strong Tower Radio Today Garden Guide program for March.
Well, I see that we have some ideas here about planting a new garden. So, Gary, what are the criteria when you're going to start to think about planting a garden should one consider?
Well, the first thing I would tell people to think about is, why do you want to do it? Because a garden is work. And a lot of times people start with these really grandiose plans about all the different things they're going to do, like they're going to can all the food they're going to need for the winter and all the fresh vegetables for the summer, and then they realize that's a lot of work and they have to plant a fairly large garden. But one of the reasons that I like to garden is fresh produce. For instance, when you harvest a head of broccoli in California, for instance, and ship it all the way across the country, it loses about 2/3 of the vitamin C.
Mm.
And so...
How long does it usually take to get from California to Michigan?
A couple of days.
2 days. Okay.
Yeah.
3 days.
So, no, they could do it in 2 days. Truckers drive for long periods of time. So when you have something in the backyard and you harvest it and you bring it right into the house and eat it.
There's nothing better than that.
There's nothing better from a standpoint of nutrition because it's at the peak of its perfection. And depending on what you do to something can affect nutrition, and maybe we'll have that discussion in the future. But also, another reason is getting outdoors. You're getting some fresh air. You're getting exercise. And especially with children, too many kids spend too much time on their phones in front of video games, and they're not getting outside like we used to do when we were young.
Yes.
And it's having an effect on health. I have heard experts say that today's children may live a shorter life period than their parents.
That's not good.
That's not good at all. Another reason you might want to...
Well, let me just pause on
okay.
that. So there's a dual benefit. Could you say, or maybe some families would say, that the garden is just taking care of the garden is a goal in itself because of the health benefits?
Oh, yeah.
And the extra benefit, the bonus, is food.
That's right. That is definitely right. But there are even other benefits, social benefits. For instance, if a person goes to a community garden, for instance, you develop relationships with people. There's relationships that are developing in the family as you're teaching your children a new skill in terms of how to take care of yourself.
Especially with our today, families are going in different directions. The kids are going off, and after mm-hmm. school, they're maybe doing a music lesson. They may be doing some sports activity, and the parents, maybe both of them are working, and family time is precious in few.
Mm-hmm. And a lot of times when we do have opportunities, we don't take advantage of it. And just go to any restaurant and watch families. Everybody has their phone.
Yes.
And now you see commercials on TV telling people, hey, put the thing down and interact with each other.
Well, that's the obvious.
Yeah, and but gardening allows you to interact, and there's so many lessons in nature that you can learn because there's so much going on in the garden that most people never even see. And the analogy I like to tell people about is, how much of the world do you see in your neighborhood when you're driving down the road at 60 miles an hour?
Not much.
If you walk that same distance, you'd be amazed at what you will see.
You'll actually see birds?
Oh, much more than that. You'll see the insects walking on the ground. You might find money. I mean, things that when you're going 60 miles an hour, you're just not going to see.
Right.
So there are many benefits besides just having food, which, of course, I really like. I like the self-sufficiency of gardening, to be able to raise my own food. That's something I've always been a do-it-yourselfer in many different ways, and so that's another thing that I like.
Is there like a realistic formula for you to figure out how big, not just where you're going to put the garden, but how big, you know, realistically that you can plant and manage?
You know, that's really mm-hmm. a great question because I started my first garden here in Cadillac, and what was the standard I used? I asked somebody else what size garden they had, and mm-hmm. I just did the same thing. Mm-hmm. Well, their commitment might be different than my commitment.
Yeah, yeah. If you were to go to a community garden, a standard plot is about 25 feet by 30 feet. Most people can handle that without too much trouble.
So how much time would you have to invest during the summer in a garden that every week? You need to plan
that. That depends.
Yeah, okay.
And it depends on what you grow because some things will require more treatment of pests than others. Other things, you can just let them grow. And like an eggplant, for instance, you don't have to worry about much bothering an eggplant. But if you're going to grow cabbage, you really have to protect it from insects and crawling insects or crawling creatures like rabbits or deer coming by, that type of thing. Also, it depends on how much work are you willing to put into that garden. For instance, do you remember what I told you we spend the most time doing in a garden?
I've forgotten. You'll have to tell me again, Gary.
Weeding.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
Weeding. On a percentage,
and I hate weeding.
Yeah. On a per-time basis, we spend more time dealing with weeds in agriculture than we do in taking care of children worldwide.
Wow.
So it's a lot of time and a lot of expense, too.
So let's take this ideal size of this community garden, 25 by 30. How much time am I going to spend weeding?
That depends.
I was afraid that was going to be the answer.
Because if you are really into using mulches, you'll have a lot of upfront time, like a field crop farmer who has to put a lot of time in the beginning to get the crop in. But once you've done everything and gotten all that mulching done, then there's very little weeding to be done. You can cut your work by, say, 90% by mulching everything.
I like that number.
Yeah, oh, yeah. I love it. And there's more.
More. Yeah, oh, yeah. Wait. There's more.
Yeah, one of the things we like to do is we will put down drip hoses in all of the rows.
Yep.
And I can even set it up to where I can put it on a timer.
Yes.
And so it'll water itself.
Oh, my. So what nutter percentage do we take out now?
Well, on a 25 by 30 garden, if you were, say, hauling water from a pump.
Yep.
And watering the garden once a week, you're probably going to spend a good 2 hours doing that.
2 hours hand watering.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if I've got a hose hooked up to it, I'd say within reach of my hydrant.
If you're using a hose and say you're using a drip hose, you can just turn it on while you're doing other things in the garden, and the garden will water itself while you're, you know, picking those two or three weeds that popped up between the mulch. So you can save an awful lot of time.
And I'm happy to report this year, I did overhead watering. There's another term for it. Mm-hmm. I had a fan spray for the last 2 years. But this year, I got a drip hose, and I'm going to put the timer on it. So I'm tracking with you real well,
yeah.
Gary.
And there's nothing... Go ahead.
Back to the weeding.
Mm-hmm.
I have a friend who gardens, and she says that for her, she doesn't mind weeding. Strange creature.
That's okay. It's but, therapeutic for some people.
But she said that she finds if she goes out every couple of days with her scuffle hoe and goes up and down the row, she calls it a racing, mm-hmm. and uses the scuffle hoe. She says, if I do that until about mid-July, she says, it seems like the weeds get kind of discouraged by that time, and I don't have to do it as often.
Well, what actually happens is when we get into July, you don't get as much rain. We usually get a flush of growth from weeds every time we get a rain. Also, if you're doing that year after year after year,
the seeds are...
When those seeds germinate, you're killing them, and you do not allow weeds to go to seed. The population of weed seed in the soil keeps going down. Of course, you bring up more seeds when you till the garden, but if you don't do much tilling... then the seeds close to the surface, the populations are low enough to where you don't have as many germinating.
And remember, you learned it here first at Strong Tower Radio Garden Guy Show.
But that all goes out the window if you allow, at the end of the season, you stop weeding and you allow weeds to go to seed.
Mm.
You have to keep on top of it.
But Gary or Sue, why don't you explain what a shuffle hoe is?
A scuffle hoe is sometimes called a stirrup hoe.
Go ahead.
They explain it. Remember, this is radio. So.
it looks kind of like a rounded triangle, flat on the bottom of the sides and on a long handle, and you slide the flat part underneath the soil, and it cuts off the weeds below there. So you just kind of push it under the soil back and forth, almost like vacuuming erasing.
For those who like math terms,
okay,
it's shaped like a trapezoid.
or geometry.
Yeah. It does have you might say both sides are sharp, and you can cut when you push and you cut
when
you
pull.
The nice thing about that is you increase your efficiency in terms of getting rid of weeds by 100%. Because a normal hoe
is a one direction.
It's a one direction type thing.
Usually pulling towards you.
Right. So, that's really nice. But you have to be careful because you can get too close to plants and you can undercut the roots of small plants and that can be a problem.
That's not good. But you
get used to it, and you can get really good at it. I have about 3 or 4 of those at home, and I wouldn't use any kind of other hole.
Well, my sister, I call her the armchair gardener because I have the garden, and she lives in an apartment. But I do have to say that over the years, literally much of what I share on the show, my minute knowledge all comes from my dear sister here. So she encouraged me to get a shuffle hole. Is that the
scuffle? Like scuffling hole. Your feet.
It has other names too, like action hoe and things like that. I think it has about 3 or 4 names, but
yes, I have one of those, and I did find that's good. But you need to get it early when those plants have a very small root base.
It will cut larger weeds, but you have to use more power. And the idea of hoeing weeds is you catch them while they're small, because if you cut them off, they don't have enough reserve energy in the roots to come back. But as certain weeds start to get bigger, for instance, purslane, you can cut it off if it's too large, and it'll just sprout right back up from the roots.
And actually, isn't purslane actually an edible weed?
Yes, it is. A lot of the weeds in the garden are edible, but hey, you know, how they taste, I don't know, because I'm so busy growing other stuff that I don't bother tasting the purslane. But if everything goes down the tubes, I know what it is.
Amen.
Just for FYI, purslane is kind of a peppery flavor. Mm-hmm. Remember we had purslane salad?
And it actually is delightful. A friend of ours, they were staying with us, and I was clearing out the garden. She's, I was weeding the garden, and it was in the weed pile. Don't throw that away. We can eat that in the salad. So, yes.
Yeah, and you can actually buy purslane.
Oh, really?
From seed catalogs, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So with that in mind, I want to ask one more lingering question on weeding. And that is do you have to sharpen your hoe?
It works better if you do.
It's easier, huh?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Good.
Now, I'm talking about the action hoe or the, yes. The what did you call it? The
scuffle
hoe. Yeah, those should be sharpened. If you have a standard hoe, you can put a little bit of an edge on it, but you don't sharpen it that much because you're just cutting off very tender weeds and it doesn't take much to kill them.
Very good. Well, we were talking about planting a garden. We were talking about weeding. It takes much of your time. I was asking the question, how much time, because time, some of us, time is very precious, and we probably should scale our garden based on the amount of time we have to
take care of,
take care of it. Now, if we do the mulching, and I went with the fabric cloth, and I've got a good source, so if anybody wants to know about this, in Central Michigan, there's a Stanwood produce auction, and you can buy some items through them, and you can buy them elsewhere, but this is in large quantities. I stocked up and got my supplies there. So I've used this fabric cloth the last couple of years. I went away for 2 weeks. I weeded the garden. I was in a hurry, and then went away for 2 weeks, and the weeds were exactly where I left them 2 weeks ago. A friend of mine loaned me his fabric cloth, and life is whole, totally different. Maybe that 90% is, I realized in when I installed the next time. So, but scaling your garden to the right size, if you've got an automatic watering system and you have a weeding system, how much time are we talking about? 5 hours a week, you can get 25 by 30 or?
Well, let's just stick with the 25 by 30 because the time that you spend depends on, of course, the size of the garden and what you're actually growing, because some things take longer. Like green beans, you're picking on a regular basis, but you
So there's different time frames. There's planting. There's
watering, weeding,
cultivation phase, yeah. And then you've got harvest phase. So each one has different time commitments, I assume.
That's right, right. But on a regular basis, if I had a 25 by 30, I probably, especially if it's mulch, I probably could spend no more than an hour in the evening. And
cultivating time.
That's during the growing until you're ready to harvest. Of course, when you get to harvest time, then you're going to spend more time.
Listen, I don't mind the harvest time. It's worth it for me. That's the joy in all the work.
It depends on how much you have. When you have 72 tomatoes, it's work.
That's right.
Is there, when you're starting this new garden, I've heard that one way to help get a labor-saving device to get yourself started is to cover the area with cardboard or newspapers.
Yeah, what I like to do now is after I've gotten the garden all cleaned out, then we put down black plastic, just cover the garden over. Yep. And that guarantees you're going to have perfectly clear soil in the spring. It makes it easier to plow. You don't have to worry about getting anything up. And I normally turn the garden over in the fall with my tiller so that any organic matter that I didn't take out and compost will be in contact with soil, which will help it to break down faster. And then if you don't want to have to
deal... So you got more microbes working on it.
Yeah, and we can talk about microbes too when we get to soil health, because that, if you really want a good, healthy garden, you really have to focus on the soil. But getting back to the covering of the garden, what I like to do is just uncover what I want to plant, and that way I don't have that flush of weeds in the spring after we have those spring rains.
Right. Well, folks, you've been listening to Strong Tower Radio today, the good growing section with the Garden Guy and with Sue Majeur and Tom Majeur. We will be back in just a couple moments.
Hello, friends. This is Doug Batchelor from Amazing Facts. Strong Tower Radio is a station that believes in the power of prayer. In the book Steps to Christ, we're told, prayer is the opening of the heart to God as to a friend. Not that it's necessary in order to make known to God what we are, but in order to enable us to receive Him. Prayer does not bring God down to us, but brings us up to Him. What a beautiful promise of God's power for our lives. Do you have a special prayer request that you'd like for us to pray for? If so, call us at 877-278-5512 or send an email through our website, strongtowerradio.org. We have a team of prayer warriors standing by to join with you in taking your petitions to the throne of grace. God loves each of us so much, and He's waiting to hear from you.
Hello, folks. Welcome back to Strong Tower Radio today. This is a second segment of our Good Growing with the Garden Guy, and we've got Gary Heilig, our expert. Welcome back, Gary.
Glad to be back.
And my sister, Sue.
Still here. Still curious.
Yeah, that's right. She's my mentor. Well, folks, in the first segment, we talked about planting a garden, and there was more depth to it than we ever thought about. We talked about weeding. That takes up to 90% unless you do some mulching or do you put down a fabric. We talked about automatic watering, which also helps increase our efficiency. We talked about we're using as an ideal size for a garden, a community garden or a personal garden of 25 by 30 foot. And we just barely touched on nutrition in the ground. And Gary was telling us that the secret to a good garden and nutrition is the soil. So, Gary, take it away.
Well, that's true. If you don't have the nutrients in the soil, then there's no way the plants can pick them up. And those various chemicals that they pick out of the ground is how they make vitamins. So you have to have the basics in the soil. And the one of the ways that we can tell what the status of our soil is a soil test. But that's not a complete picture because there's a lot more to soil fertility than just nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium. For instance, organic matter, how much organic matter you have in the soil will determine how healthy your soil is. Organic matter can act as a sponge, which can help hold water when you put it in the soil. So when you have a drought, for instance, your plants can get through that drought better if you have good organic matter levels. And we like to see somewhere between 3 and 5%, but that's the lower level that we like to see. Also, plants pick up nutrients in water, and they get those nutrients as they're released from various particles in the soil, like sand, silt, and clay. Although sand can't hold anything because it doesn't have an electrical charge, silt has a negative charge, so anything that's positively charged, like potassium, will adhere to that particle.
Okay.
And also same thing with silt. But organic matter can also hold nutrients of various types. And the more you have, the more nutrients they can hold. Also, if you were to dig in your soil and you see lots of earthworms, that's an indication, and various other types of worms too.
That's an indicator.
That's an indicator that you have a healthy soil. Now, you'll tend to have lower levels of earthworms in very sandy soils because they have very low organic matter levels. But if you have lots of worms there, that's an indication that your soil's in pretty good shape. The worms process decaying organic matter, and as it goes through their little bodies, when it comes out the other end, those nutrients are in a form that plants can pick it up. Also, worms will dig holes through the soil, which allows water to move down through the soil, air to penetrate through the soil, and roots will follow those areas and are able to get down deeper. Path of least resistance, that's right. Also, things that you can't see that are going on in the soil, you will have things like enzymes. And if you remember from chemistry, enzymes are product that actually can speed up a reaction. And they can speed up the reaction of plants being able to pick up nutrients. And there are various other biostimulators in the soil that can help plants to resist diseases. And there's just all this interplay of different things. And it all is dealing with organic matter. So if you're adding organic matter to your garden over time, you are building a much healthier soil.
I heard that President Jefferson, who was a passionate gardener with very large gardens, his daughter wrote to him, they were having trouble with cabbages or something, worms. And he wrote back that how important it was to fertilize and so on. He said, what was his phrase? If they are well fed and mm-hmm. make them healthy, they will bid defiance against the...
Bid defiance is a good term, but what plants do have some ability to fight off invaders. But some of invaders can just overwhelm them, because many things that we have to deal with in our gardens today were not naturally here when people came over from Europe.
What are you talking about?
For instance, the imported cabbage worm, that little white cabbage, yes. a butterfly that you see.
Yeah, all around my broccoli and
right.
my cauliflower.
Did you catch the first word of its name? Imported?
Yes. You mean it was purposefully brought here?
Well, not necessarily purposely. A lot of things are accidentally introduced, but once it's here,
species?
Yeah, basically. But once it's here, it may not have any type of predator to keep its populations under control like they would be in their natural habitat.
Right.
And so they become a major pest here. But plants do have the ability to make some chemical changes when they're attacked.
Mm.
And they can ward off certain things. But they do that better when they're in a good state of health. If a plant is stressed, it's more likely to have a problem.
It makes a lot of sense.
Mm-hmm. When you're doing the soil testing, as you spoke about the chemicals in there, can you also have testing that'll tell you, like, you need to add this to your soil because it's too heavy a clay or it's too sandy? And if you do, let's say you have that area, the whole garden isn't going to be the same. Won't you have to take soil tests from different parts of where you plan to be in the garden?
In most home gardens, the soil will be the same in the areas that, I mean, you'd have to have a really huge area before you can notice much of a difference. There are some situations where there may not be that much of a difference. For instance, on my property, if you're on the northern end of the property, it's almost pure sand. If you get to the southern end, it's a heavier textured loam. And that's probably over about a 500-foot distance, maybe a little bit more.
With that in mind, can you use that to your advantage? You have two different soil types?
You can. There's certain things that do better on well-drained soils and lighter textured soils, like potatoes, for instance, than on a heavier textured soil. But on a general loam soil, which is what I have on the southern end, there's no limitations. It's still good soil. Now, going back to your question about adding stuff to the soil, you're talking about changing what we call the texture of the soil. You might have a sandy loam or a general loam, which is about equal parts of sand, silt, and clay. Or you might have an organic soil, which is more than 20% organic matter. That you can't change easily. I mean, if you dump loads of something on an area, and I'm talking about 10 to 20 inches, yeah, you can change the texture that way. But generally, we tell people, texture you can't change. What you can do is improve what you have, and the secret, again, is adding organic matter.
Wow. Would you list those types of soil one more time? Because I think some of our listeners will want to take notes.
Well, mineral soils are made up of three different components.
Okay.
Sand, silt, and clay. And you can have different percentages of those. So if, say, for instance, if you have a very high percentage of sand in your soil, you might have something called a loamy sand. Or if you have higher percentages of organic matter and sand and silt in it, it might be considered a sandy loam. There is a triangle that we classify soil texture based on the percentage of each of those things in your soil.
Is this a graphic? Or?
Yeah, triangle? It's a graphic that you can find online. Also, as I mentioned earlier, once a soil increases the organic matter level, or it has an organic matter level of 20% or more, we're calling that an organic soil. Many people call them muck soils. They're dark black.
So that's where, you know, in some areas around Grand Rapids and Kalamazoo, you see dark black soils. I mean, it's amazingly dark compared to most of the soils we see in many areas.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like celery and onions,
they grow
there?
Celery, radishes, onions, lettuce. Those are the major things that they will grow on them. But you probably would not want to have to deal with that because that stuff tracks into the house very easily.
Does it stick to your boots?
And yeah, it'll stick to your shoes. And also when they get wet, they're really mucky. And they're good soils for growing things. But if you have very large areas of them, if there's no cover on them in the spring when we have those heavy winds, you see the soil just blowing away.
Yes, you see dust storms.
Yeah.
We had lived in southern Illinois, and the field behind our house, you would walk out there, and when it was wet, it would collect. It would almost double the size of your boot. What type of soil would that be? It would have to be a clay of some sort, I would assume.
When you say double the size of your boot, what do you mean?
I mean, your boot became so heavy and large, it just clung to your boot.
Yeah, that's clay. Yeah,
that's my son went out there once, and he called me, "Help, Dad! I can't get out."
If it's enough water in there so that it's almost like a quicksand, you'll sink down about 4 to 6 inches, and you'll pull your leg up, and your boot stays there, and you can't get it out easily.
We took out one boot, and I think one of them came off, one sinks, and you get 1 foot out, and then it repeats. It's scary.
And the thing about having that type of a soil, clay soil, those are slow to dry out. A lot of people say, oh, I have clay soil. But clay soils are some of the richest soils in terms of nutrients because it has that high cation exchange capacity, the ability to hold and release nutrients. And so you just need to know how to manage those soils. You have to wait until they're drier, and then you till them. Otherwise, when you till them, you basically have this big mucky bricks, and then when they dry, they're like bricks, and you have to beat it apart.
And I believe in Lansing, that's the type of soils we had on the west side of Lansing. I don't know, you're in the Eaton Rapids area. Do you have that also?
There's clay. The primary soil type in Ingham County, for instance.
Yes, okay. That's Lansing.
That's Lansing area. Is something called K-Pak clay.
Wow.
But when you're
I would have known that when we were young.
Well, there's something called a soil survey map that can tell you the kind of soils you have. But if you are in a city, they don't really apply because there's been so much construction and so much stirring up of the soils.
The topsoil's been ripped off.
Maps aren't any good anymore. But when you get out into the country, they're still good.
Is that one of the reasons that you might want to consider the raised beds? Because then you can control what kind of soil that you're having and tailor it to the kind of crop that you really want to have.
Well, a raised bed will allow you to start growing sooner because it'll drain faster. It'll heat up faster. If you do have a poor quality soil, having a raised bed and bringing in a soil is a beneficial thing.
Let's pause for a second. My co-host Jelaine always makes us define everything. So what is a raised bed, and is there different types of raised beds?
Yeah, there are. A raised bed is simply where you're planting above the grade.
Okay.
And it can be a contained raised bed where you actually have wood around the edges of the bed. Or it could be uncontained where you basically are growing on berms or small hills. And the reason people do that is when they have drainage issues, a raised bed will drain faster, they can plant sooner. And raised beds that are contained by wood, for instance, by cedar or treated lumber, allows you to have a much neater looking garden. And you can raise that garden up to whatever height you want it to be. For instance, I think the tallest wood that you can get is about 12 inches. And you can buy a little garden cart and sit down and not have to bend over as much. Or you can build it up to the point to where you can garden in a wheelchair. So
you basically put stilts on it, if you wish, or something that raises it.
Well, you could do that, or I do have a garden like that, a raised bed that's on construction bricks. But you can also build it right up from the ground so that it's solid wood up to whatever point you want.
I saw something where they took like hay or straw bales, especially if they were last year's, and used that around the edge of the raised bed. And they also would like kind of pull the bale apart a little bit and stick tomato plants and stuff in there, mm-hmm. and grow it too. And it would decompose. You could add more as time goes by.
You can do that. That's not going to be the most attractive thing in your landscape because one of the reasons why people use wood is they want a nice, neat garden. And when you just dig out a garden in the yard, unless you're really meticulous about the edges and that type of thing, it's usually a little less formal.
Well, you've kind of opened up a pan, Sue, you've opened up a Pandora's box of raised beds. When I had a person introduce me to raised beds, and mine, of course, I brought out about the wooden stilts that you have 4x4s and you build it up to a certain level and it's convenient. You can, mm-hmm. you don't have to bend over, especially if a person's getting older and stuff uh-huh. like that, or with the wheelchair example. Mm-hmm. But Sue, you brought up about the hay, the straw. Straw would probably be better than hay because it has less seeds in it, I assume.
It should if it's clean straw, clean but not straw. Necessarily.
And then you were mentioning, Gary, as just anything that goes above the grade. And so there's three different types of raised bed. And then mm-hmm. probably you had also mentioned something about using construction bricks also.
Yeah, I had made one that's probably about 7 inches deep. And it's almost waist height, but the bed itself isn't that deep. Now, that does limit what I can grow in there. I can grow certain types of carrots. I use it primarily
because of root depth.
Root depth, yeah. And see, a tomato, for instance, will go down 6 feet. So if I put a tomato plant in there, it's going to send roots in throughout that entire raised bed because it's looking for space for those roots to grow. But that bed's not really designed for deep rooting things.
Is that horizontally or vertically?
If it can't go down, it'll go out.
Okay.
So although I can grow tomatoes in there, it's not the best use of that bed.
So let me make sure I've got the picture right. You said it's only 7 inches deep. What's you said it's about waist high. Mm-hmm. What's underneath all that?
It's like a box. It has a bottom and everything. But underneath it is those construction bricks that you see around the foundation of a house to bring it up higher. That's all.
Okay, so you have plywood in the bottom, or what do you?
It's the same treated wood that I have on the sides. It's about
your
half
planks.
Inch thick. Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
So if you had a raised bed that's say it's like a berm, you've built it up like a berm, mm-hmm. would that be appropriate for a person that wanted to, say, grow potatoes?
You could. Normally, people will just dig a hole, put potatoes in, and as the plants grow, they'll hill up around it. But yeah, you could do that.
I've heard in our climate here that you can grow sweet potatoes in a wheelbarrow by putting it in there, and then when it's cold or it's frosty, you just wheel it into the garage and take it in and out. Do you think that would actually work?
Yeah, you could probably do that. People grow potatoes in straw, and so I don't see why you couldn't grow sweet potatoes that way. As long as the plants can have their roots protected, they're kept moist, and there's a way for them to pick up nutrients. Soil is the means by which plants get exchange of nutrients, but you can grow plants without any soil at all. We call that hydroponics.
Hydroponics, yeah.
So soil is the medium for exchange of nutrients. So there are many different things that you can use for the medium of exchange. Straw will work as long as it doesn't dry out and you make sure that it gets the nutrients that it needs. Now, whether I would wheel it into the garage, it'll still get cold enough in the garage where your sweet potatoes would freeze.
I think that was our frost nights, and then they wheel it back out during the day. At least I think that was the idea.
Yeah, that's too much work for me.
About the organic things, you know, one of the topics that we were going to talk about, and talking about the pests and mm-hmm. so on, I've heard of something called BT that they use, like, on those cabbage butterflies you were talking about. Uh-huh. Is that considered organic?
Yes and no.
You know, with that answer, we're going to take a break and let you'll have to wait till the third segment to get the answer to BT. Stay tuned, folks. You're listening to Strong Tower Radio today, The Good Gardening with the Gardening Guy, Gary Heilig and Sue Majeure. We'll be right back.
The Bible and God's character are under attack like never before. Here at Strong Tower Radio, we are proud to hold up the Bible as a lamp unto our feet and a light unto our path. We believe the Bible is the Word of God and contains the good news of God's character and His great plan of salvation for mankind. If you know and believe this to be true, won't you help Strong Tower Radio proclaim the truth about our God and His Word, the Bible? To do that, go to www.strongtowerradio.org and there, on our secure website, you will find a donate button. Click on that and give as the Lord directs. Thank you for listening and supporting Strong Tower Radio, where God's character is proclaimed.
Hello, folks. Welcome back to Good Gardening with the Garden Guy, our March edition. We have Gary Heilig, a retired extension agent from Michigan State University, and my co-host, Sue Majeure. Welcome back, Sue. You left us hanging on a question. Will you repeat that question?
I would like to know if BT, which is used for, like, say, cabbage butterflies, keep those little white worms off your broccoli and your cabbage, is considered organic or not.
And we have to ask, what is BT?
Yeah, BT is a abbreviation for Bacillus thuringiensis. It's a bacteria. It occurs naturally in the soil.
And that sounds good.
There are many different types of BT used for different things. But this particular one is used to control insects in an order of insects called the Lepidoptera, which includes butterflies and moths. And the way it works is when you spray it on, the insects will ingest the bacteria, which produce something called an endotoxin in their digestive tract, and it makes them sick. And essentially, they die within a few days. Now, when you ask the question, is it organic, it is a biological pesticide, but whether or not it can be used for organic use depends on what else is in the container. Some formulations may put something called an adjuvant in there, which actually helps the product work better. But if it isn't cleared by OMRI, which is the organic, it's Organic Review and Materials Institute, and if it's not cleared by them, then it cannot be used for organic production.
So reading your labels is very important.
Yeah, there is a label that has OMRI on it if it's cleared for organic production. But it is considered an organic pesticide.
Is there something besides this substance that accelerates or enhances the BT that we have to be concerned if you want to be truly organic?
Well, the substance itself isn't a big issue because adjuvants are used all over the world in a number of different things. But if you want to do something where you're going to call it organic production, there are certain rules you have to follow. And that's that.
Okay. Now, you said it is good or in affecting these pests. But will it hurt my beautiful monarch butterfly or something that I like?
Highly unlikely, because monarch butterflies like to be on milkweed.
That's
so
true.
So unless you're out there spraying the milkweed, you have nothing to worry about.
And this is, it only has a residual for, you said, 2 or 3 days?
Yes, that's one of the advantages of organic pesticides, is that they have shorter residuals in the environment. They tend to be more specific in terms of what they affect. But these are bacteria, and bacteria that are exposed to sunlight are exposed to ultraviolet rays, which causes them to die. So after about 3 or 4 days, then the effectiveness starts to decrease.
So that's kind of a good thing, because you have a narrow target. You're not hurting other things with overspray. There will be some overspray, but it'll be limited. So it's a strategic, wise stewardship.
Yeah, it's a good product to use. It's not going to harm people at all. You could drink the stuff and it wouldn't hurt you.
Well, does that mean that the friendly bugs you want in your garden, like, say, your ladybugs, your lacewings, your praying mantis, your flower spiders, will be unaffected by it?
Unaffected, because they're not in that air. They're not in the same order So it's the Lepidoptera butterflies and moths. Just those guys.
Now, let me just double check. I went to one of my extension agents here in Wexford, Meeusaukee County, and I want to encourage our listeners that there are a lot of good programs, used to teach programs.
I still do.
Still do.
Mm-hmm.
And yours is probably, which county do you, who do you work with?
I work with a number of different counties. I teach the Master Gardener program all over the state.
Yeah, he's in great demand, folks. So maybe you want to invite, have your agent invite Gary to your area and get to hear him in person on an evening.
And I still do supper clubs, too.
Oh, supper clubs, yes. Do you talk about food or do you talk about growing?
It depends on what they want to talk about.
You're multi-talented, mm-hmm. and you sing very well, too.
Well, no, now we're going too far.
Okay. Well, he sings with a group with the Lansing, East Lansing Seventh-day Adventist Church.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yes. But multi-talented here. But my sister Sue has a question.
Is this about the time of year, or should we wait a little longer to start seeds indoors to go outside? And what is hardening off?
Yes, it's time to start some things. For instance, I will probably start some peppers as soon as they get home because they take longer to germinate and they slower to grow. We like to suggest at least 6 to 8 weeks. I prefer 8 to 10 weeks before you want to set something out. That's when you should start your seeds.
And that's what you were talking about. No, that's not hardening.
It's no, just, that's not hardening off. That's just trying to start them.
Yeah.
Hardening off is a process where you're preparing a plant that has been grown under ideal conditions, like in a greenhouse or in a home.
In a protected environment.
Protected environment. You have a nice steady temperature. They're getting all the water they need. They're getting perfect fertilization. And one of the problems with that is when they're grown under artificial lights, they don't develop a very thick cuticle, which is the waxy covering on the surface of the leaf. And that waxy covering does two things. One, it protects against ultraviolet rays from the sun. And second, it keeps the plant from drying out.
Mm.
In other words, we call that desiccation. And if you don't harden them off, in other words, start getting them acclimated to higher light levels over a period of about a week to 10 days, if you were to set your plant outside, you're going to get some damage on that plant. And on my YouTube channel, I have a whole series of videos on growing transplants. And one of them is called hardening off. And I actually show you what happens if you take a plant and put it directly out in the sunlight.
So you have real life examples on your video.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And speaking of that, Gary, we haven't brought up your YouTube channel and video. We'll give you a chance because our listeners, this is radio, so we have the auditory channel. But Gary has a video, and go ahead and introduce your videos.
It's a YouTube channel. It's called Get Growing with Gary. Or you can just type in my name at a search engine, Gary Heilig, H-E-I-L-I-G. And I have different playlists, and I'm always trying to add new things. I haven't been doing a lot lately because I've had the flu, but I have about 100 videos now up, and they'll just keep coming.
So, folks, Gary, give us that address. It's Get Growing with Gary, right?
Right, or you can just type in my name, Gary Heilig, H-E-I-L-I-G.
Well, thank you very much. I'm glad we took time to look at that. Now, hardening off, were you talking about when you grow this yourself under your own conditions, or does this hardening off also apply to when you get late in the season, you get towards May, depending on your area, and you go to your local garden center and you buy those plants in the trays? Do those need to be hardened off?
No, they've already gone through that process.
Oh, really?
Because when you go to a place like Lowe's or Home Depot's or Menards, they're sitting right out in the sun. So they've already gone through that.
That's good to know.
It's like plug and play when you buy those.
All right. But you don't get the joy from the seed to harvest.
And that's a really nice family thing to do, too, especially if kids want to do something on their own and they want to grow a particular flower or a particular vegetable. Most kids do not understand how food works, and it's a really good thing for them to learn from the very beginning, even when you're going through the catalogs in the spring. or even during the winter, because they're usually out by Christmas. And they can help choose some of the vegetables you're going to grow, help plant them, care for them. And they really realize what it takes to put something on the table when they've had a chance to participate.
And it doesn't always work either. You have to deal with success and failure.
Well, you can. I remember one year that I went over and looked at a garden that had been hit with hail. It was just destroyed. Mm-hmm. It was hail that preceded a tornado through that area. And there was no garden. Mm. I mean,
that's sad.
You could do everything right, and one hailstorm can end your season.
Yeah, and same thing with pests, can do it within 2 or 3 days, too.
They can. Usually you can see that coming, though. There are lots of resources that will tell you what's coming up, and you can get a lot of those resources from your local extension office. And if you're forewarned, then all you have to do is be prepared.
There you go. Well, you alluded to the family and doing things with kids, and we dealt with that in the first segment. One thing of the benefits is doing things together, that planning process of deciding what are we going to grow. And there's interaction with my kids, not necessarily with gardening, but when they wanted to have a project, they would, "Dad, I want you to build this for me." Mm-hmm. I said, "I want you to design it first. I want you to draw it out." Mm-hmm. Designing is kind of intimidating, but I want you to get a piece of paper, and I want you to put on the paper what you want it to look like, whether it be a birdhouse or anything like that. And I think with the garden, there's so many lessons that you can learn by dimensions and planning and such. There's just so many opportunities, and the best thing of all is you're talking with your kids.
Well, on the way up, I was listening to this radio station called Strong Tower Radio. And they were talking
about... You don't listen to anything else. I know that.
And they were talking about education.
Yes.
And they were saying that these experts were saying the first 10 years of a child's life, nature should be their classroom.
Amen. Absolutely.
And when you really think about it, when you go to college, you have two different classes a lot of times. One is called the lecture, and one is called the lab.
Correct.
And it's the labs where you learn the most, because it's hands-on. You're not only seeing, you're listening, you're doing.
And you're remembering.
And so that lab of nature, there's so many things that kids can learn if they just have a chance to get out there and experience it. And gardening is a great way to do it.
Now, back to the particular plant or whatever thing.
Okay.
I'm going to ask a question about a particular passion. Tom's going to say, "I know which one this is."
It's ground cherries.
I've been trying to get him to plant those for the last 2 years. So, Gary, what is the best way to do ground cherries?
When you say best way to do, what do you mean by that?
Start them inside from seed. And transplant, and how long before they go out in the garden?
Actually, I think I've just been ambushed here.
Well, I guess the first question I want to ask is, when you're talking about ground cherries, are you talking about a bush?
It's in the tomato family. It's the one that's got the little papery husks on it.
Okay, I think of that one as, the husk tomato. Are you talking about that one, the green one?
It's not green. It's not like the tomatillo. They're about the size of the end of your thumb. Mm-hmm. And they have sort of a tan, papery husk. Mm-hmm. And they're golden yellow.
I've never grown those. Have you used them for anything?
Eating. I had them at the farmer's market, and they're delicious. They taste like spiced pineapple. They're like candy.
Interesting.
Delicious. But I see the seeds, but I haven't.
Well, have you seen the seeds in garden catalogs?
Yeah, they're there or online. You can order the seeds.
Okay. Is this an annual?
Yes.
Okay. Well, if it's an annual, then you can start it yourself, because we should have enough time in Michigan to grow it. But since I'm not real familiar with how long it takes for it to grow, I would start it earlier than later. That way, if it takes a very long period of time, then at least you have a chance of getting it to produce for you. It's easier for you to hold a plant that's getting a little large in the spring, because you can keep it outside, you can put it in pots until you're ready to put it in the ground, than it is to try to speed a plant up that's been planted too late.
Ah, take note, Tom.
So I would probably start it during March.
I have a feeling that after this program, we're going to go down to the seed catalog and place an order.
That's right.
You know what? You're not the only one. Because when somebody asks me a question about something that I'm not familiar with, guess what I do?
Well, maybe we better order double.
Well, I do know that they can grow here because I bought them in the farmer's market. Mm-hmm. I was really curious. And she said, would you like to taste them? I said, yes. I bought 2 pints. And one pint never even made it home.
And how do they normally eat them? Are we talking about just eating them like you would eat a berry?
Yeah, just like, you know, they're like a tiny...
Cherry tomato?
Yeah, well, like a tiny grape tomato kind of thing. You just, it's a loose papery brown husk. You pull it back and they're like a golden orange color.
Is it used in salads or how is it used?
You can use it just like any tomato, but people also make like tomato... looking it up a little bit, they use it for like tomato jam, or you can make pies with it, and so on. I guess it's more of an old-fashioned thing, so people don't see it as much, and you can't buy it at Meijer's or anything, but I'm telling you, they're delicious. They're like candy, like spiced pineapple. Mmm, yummy.
Oh, interesting. I've never tasted that.
But they're called ground cherries, as I understand it, because you don't pick them off the plant. They're not ripe till they fall off, so you know when they're ripe. They're on the ground.
Well, folks, let's talk about the difference between biostimulants and biopesticides. What are they? First of all, define it.
Okay. A biopesticide is a pesticide that's derived from a biological organism. It might be a plant. It might be an insect. Or it might be... a derivative of some biological process. A biostimulant is a material that can induce some type of response from a plant. And there's a lot of work being done in this right now in commercial agriculture, where they'll put a biostimulant on to induce higher levels of glucose, which is a sugar in plants. Or it might induce a response against a particular pest, for instance. So it's sort of like taking something to ramp up your immune system.
Okay.
Does that mean that they're genetically modified?
No. Mm-mm. You really can't genetically modify a biostimulant. It's like a chemical. And many of these things are derived naturally, and maybe we should do a program on some of these different things.
Sure.
And talk about specific things. But you're seeing more interest in these types of materials, biocontrols for controlling pests, and commercial agriculture is really getting interested in it because it's helping with improving yields, and of course that's what they're all about. And they're used in organic practices also, so it's not one of these either-or type of things.
Well, folks, our time has flown away, as it always does on this show. I want to thank again Gary Heilig for being our garden guy. And Gary, would you give us your YouTube channel one more time?
It's Get Growing with Gary, or you can just look up my name, Gary, with one R, and Heilig is H-E-I-L-I-G.
And I want to thank you for being our trusted garden guy. And we'll be back next month with another program. And I want to thank my sister, Sue. It's just a pleasure to do you, not only as your wonderful sister, but you're a good garden host.
Oh, it's always been fun.
Well, folks, until next month or next week with another Strong Tower Radio Today program. Bye now.